I have brought you the head of the white Wazungu, Piri the hunter announced dramatically, and unslung the net bag of plaited bark fibre from his shoulder and dropped it in front of Chetty Singh. The head rolled out of the bag, and Chetty Singh jumped back and exclaimed with revulsion. There was no skin left on the head. The raw meat was putrefying, and the stench was fierce enough to make him gag. "How do I know that this is the head of the white Wazungu?" Chetty Singh demanded. "Because I, Piri, the hunter, say it is so." "That's not the highest recommendation, never mind," Chetty Singh said in English, and then reverted to Swahili. "This man has been dead a long time. The ants and the worms have half eaten him. You did not kill him, Piri."
"No," Piri admitted. "This stupid Wazungu had eaten a poison mushroom and died in the forest before I could find him and kill him. The ants had eaten him, as you say. But I have brought you his head, and that was our bargain."
Piri mustered all his dignity and drew himself up to his full 4'6". "Now you must give me what you promised me, especially the tobacco." It was a long and forlorn hope. Even Piri realized that. To obtain this head, Piri had exhumed one of the mass graves that the Haita guards had dug in the forest for the corpses of the slave laborers who died in the camps.
"You are certain that this is the head of the white Wazungu?" Chetty Singh demanded.
He did not believe the pygmy, but on the other hand he had to placate both Ning Cheng Gong and President Tafari. He dared not admit to them that there was a possibility that Armstrong had escaped. Piri was offering him an easy exit from his dilemma.
"It is the Wazungu,"
Piri affirmed, and Chetty Singh thought about it for a while.
"Take this," he touched the reeking head with his toe. "Take it back into the forest and bury it."
"What about my reward? Especially the tobacco?"
Piri's tone became an ingratiating whine.
"You did not bring me the whole head. The skin and hair were missing. Therefore I cannot give you the whole reward. And I will give it to you only when you bring me the teeth of the elephant, as we agreed."
Piri let out a shout of anger and drew his machete.
"Put that knife away," said Chetty Singh reasonably, "or I will shoot your head off with this."
He showed the pygmy the Tokarev pistol concealed in his pocket. Piri's scowl became a beatific smile.
"It was only a little joke, O master. I am your slave."
And he sheathed the machete.
"I will go and fetch the teeth of the elephant as you command."
He picked up the severed head. But as he skipped away into the forest, Piri's guts and chest were filled with so much anger that he thought they might burst.
"Nobody cheats Piri," he whispered, and slashed at a tree trunk with the machete as he ran. "Piri will kill the man who cheats him," he promised. "You want a head, O one-armed and greasy man? I will give you a head. Your own."
"Daniel Armstrong is dead," Chetty Singh told them. "The Bambuti brought me his head. He died in the forest."
"There can be no doubt," President Tafari demanded.
"None at all," Chetty Singh affirmed. "I saw the head with my personal eyes."
"That means the woman is the only living witness," Ning Cheng Gong looked relieved. "You should get rid of her immediately, Your Excellency. She should disappear in the forest just the way that Armstrong did."
Ephraim Tafari picked up his empty glass and rattled the ice cubes. Captain Keijo hurried across the room and took the glass from his hand. At the small bar in the corner of the president's office, he poured gin and tonic.
"Aren't you forgetting the videotape?" Tafari asked,
as Keijo respectfully handed him the drink.
"Of course not," Cheng said. "But once she has recovered the tape from the embassy, we must get rid of her."
He hesitated. "I could arrange that personally." Ephraim Tafari smiled at him over the rim of the glass.
"Ah, yes," he nodded. "I have heard that you have a rather unusual hobby, Mr. Ning."
"I am not quite sure why you are implying, Mr. President," he answered stiffly. "I were merely offering to make certain that the job were done properly. We don't want any more loose ends."
"Quite right, Mr. Ning," Tafari agreed. "The woman is becoming a bore. I have lost interest in her. Once we have recovered the tape, she is yours. Just make certain that there are no mistakes."
"Trust me, Mr. President."
"Oh yes, Mr. Ning, I trust you just as completely as you trust me. After all, we are partners, are we not?"
"My arrangement with Danny was that he would pick it up personally,"
Sir Michael Hargreave inspected his fingernails with some interest, and then placed his hand in his pocket and went to the window of his office in the British Embassy. He looked out over the lake. Daniel didn't say anything about handing it over to a third party. You must understand my position, Miss Mahoon. The punker fan on the ceiling squeaked and whirled, and Bonnie thought quickly. She knew that she must not appear too eager, even though she was acutely aware of what the consequences might be if she returned to Ephraim empty-handed. I didn't realize it would be a problem, she stood up. Danny asked me to pick it up. He'll probably be bitter with me for not bringing it back, but I don't imagine the tape is of any real importance. I'm sorry, I didn't think to ask Danny for a note. Anyway, thank you for your time, and I'll explain to Danny that you couldn't see your way clear to handing the tape to me. She held out her hand and gave him her sexiest smile, thrusting out her bosom. Sir Michael's gaze wavered from her eyes, and then he seemed to make up his mind. Oh, look here. I suppose it'll be all right. I mean, you are Danny's assistant. Not as though you were a total stranger. He hesitated. I don't want you to do anything you feel is not right, Bonnie told him. I'm sure Danny will understand that you didn't trust me. Good Lord, my dear young lady, it isn't a case of not trusting you. Oh, that's what I thought it was. She fluttered her eyelids at him. Would you mind signing a receipt? Sorry to be so awkward, but I must cover myself with Danny. I understand, Sir Michael. He scribbled out a receipt on a sheet of the embassy stationery, and she signed it and wrote out her full name and passport number at the foot of the page. Sir Michael went into the adjoining room, and she heard him put a key into a lock, and then the metallic sound of the door lugs of a steel safe opening and closing. A few minutes later, he returned and handed her a bulky manila envelope, with Daniel's name printed on it. She tried not to make her relief apparent, but her hand shook as he handed it to her. "Please give Danny my best salams," Sir Michael walked her to the front door of the embassy. "When is he coming back from Sengi Sengi?" "I am flying up to join him there this afternoon." Bonnie had her nerves under control and chatted easily. They shook hands at the door. "Having one of our regular cocktail parties next Saturday," Sir Michael said. "If you and Danny are back in town by then, you must come along. I'll have Miss Rogers send you an invitation to the guest house." The news of Daniel Armstrong's disappearance had not yet been reported to the embassy. Ephraim Tafari wanted all the loose ends tidied up before the alarm was raised. Bonnie went out to where Captain Cajo was waiting at the wheel of an army Land Rover. She clutched the envelope in her lap, but managed another smile and wave for Sir Michael as they pulled out of the embassy gates. Then she let out a deep breath and fell back against the seat. "President Tafari is waiting for you on his yacht, Miss Moon," Captain Cajo told her, and took the lakeside road down to the harbour. The yacht was moored at the naval jetty beyond the fish factory. The vessel had been the toy of a wealthy Asian businessman, one of those whom Tafari had deported and sent back to the United Kingdom when he came to power. Of course, he had confiscated all the Asians' property, and this vessel was now the presidential yacht. It was a 45-foot Camper and Nicholson with lovely lines, equipped with every luxury, although most of the electronic equipment had long ago failed and had not been replaced, and the paintwork and sails were no longer pristine. However, the bar was well stocked, and since the yacht very seldom left its berth, the lack of navigational and sailing gear was not critical. There were two men in the main cabin, seated at the red teak saloon table facing each other. President Tafari was perusing the monthly operating report and profit and loss accounts of UDC, smiling and nodding as he did so. Ning Cheng Gong was watching him expectantly. When Tafari lowered the document and looked up, Cheng answered his smile. "I am very impressed, Mr. Ning. It is only a very short time since you arrived at Ubomo to take control of the company, but the results are really quite spectacular." "You are very gracious, Your Excellency," Cheng bowed slightly. "But I can truthfully say that I expect an even greater improvement in the months ahead. There were many problems that my English predecessor left for me, but these are being resolved." "What about the vehicle maintenance depot? This is one of my major areas of concern," Tafari's smile faded. "And rightly so, Mr. President. We have over 1,000 heavy vehicles in service, not counting the actual Momu installation. Our maintenance costs were earning
at over $3 million a month when I took over. Ah, you can see I have managed to reduce these by almost 40%. Their discussion lasted another hour before there were footsteps on the deck outside and a polite knock on the cabin door. "Who is it?" Tafari called. "It's Captain Keijo, Mr. President, and Miss Maun." Tafari glanced at Cheng significantly, and the Chinaman nodded. This was the reason that the meeting was being held on board the yacht, rather than in the boardroom at Lake House. "Come in," Tafari ordered, and the door slid aside. Keijo stooped his long frame into the cabin and saluted awkwardly. "I have Miss Maun waiting in the Land Rover on the dock," he reported. "Did she pick up the packet?" Tafari asked anxiously. "Yes, sir, she has it with her." Again, Tafari and Cheng exchanged glances, but now both of them were smiling again. "All right, Captain," Tafari nodded. "You have your orders." "Yes, Mr. President. I am to accompany Mr. Ning and Miss Maun on the expedition to Lamu Island, and I am to..." "No need to repeat them, Captain," Tafari interrupted. "Just carry them out to the letter. Now you may bring Miss Maun aboard." She burst into the cabin and went directly to Ephraim Tafari, ignoring the other man at the table. "I've got it, Ephraim," she gloated. "Here it is." She laid the envelope in front of him, and he picked it up, tore it open, and shook out the video cassette. "Are you sure this is the one?" "Yes, that's my notation on the label, my handwriting. It's the one, all right." "Well done. I am extremely pleased with you," Tafari told her. "Come and sit beside me, my dear." She accepted the offer with alacrity, and Tafari laid his hand on her thigh below the tabletop. "Captain Keijo," Tafari ordered, "there's a bottle of champagne in the refrigerator. This calls for a celebration." Keijo went to the bar and busied himself with the bottle. The cork popped, and a little froth gushed out onto the carpet. It was Australian rather than French, but none of them complained. Keijo turned back to the bar, screening the row of glasses on the bar top, while he poured the wine. He gave Bonnie her glass first, and then served the others in order of their seniority. Tafari lifted his glass towards Bonnie. "To you, my dear. You have saved me and my country from a potentially damaging situation."
"Thank you, Mr. President." Bonnie took a mouthful of the champagne.
She noticed, but did not remark, on the slightly bitter aftertaste, for she had learned not to give him the least pretext for offence. And when Keijo refilled her glass, she drank it without question. The unpleasant taste was less noticeable now.
"I thought we might go for a sunset cruise on the lake," Tafari told her.
And Bonnie smiled at him, but her cheeks felt strangely numb.
"That would be fun," she tried to say, but it came out slurred and jumbled.
Bonnie broke off and stared at them. Their faces were receding and there was a ringing sound in her head. It became louder and her vision was darkening. There was only a tiny hole in the centre of the blackness in which she could see Ephraim's face, as though through the reverse end of a telescope, small and remote. His voice boomed and echoed in her drugged brain.
"Goodbye, my dear," he said.
And her head dropped forward onto the tabletop. There was silence in the cabin for a full minute after Bonnie Maun had collapsed. Then President Tafari gathered his papers and placed them in his briefcase. He stood up, and Keijo hurried to the open door for him. Tafari paused in the doorway and looked back. Ning Cheng Gong was still seated opposite the unconscious girl. He was watching her with a strange, pale intensity. At the head of the gangplank, Tafari paused to talk to Captain Keijo.
"Make sure that the yacht is washed down thoroughly before you bring her back to port. You know how to use the pressure hose?"
"I do, Your Excellency."
Tafari went down the gangplank to his Mercedes, and Keijo stood to attention and saluted as he drove away. The yacht's diesel engine was already running, the exhausts bubbling softly under the stern. Keijo cast off the lines and went to the wheel. He eased the yacht away from the jetty and turned her bows towards the harbour entrance. It was a 2-hour run out to Lamu Island, and the sun had already set when he dropped anchor in the lee of the uninhabited, horseshoe-shaped rock.
"We have arrived, Mr. Ning," he said into the voice tube. "Help me, please, Captain."
Keijo went down into the cabin. Bonnie Mahoon was lying, still unconscious, on the carpeted deck. Between them they carried her up into the open cockpit, and while Keijo held her upright, Ning strapped her wrists and ankles to the stainless steel railings. He spread a nylon sheet under her, with the end dangling over the stern, to make it easier to hose down the deck later.
"I don't need any further assistance," he told Keijo. "Take the rubber dinghy and go ashore on the island. Stay there until I call you. No matter what you may hear, you will remain ashore. Do you understand?"
"Yes, Mr. Ning."
Cheng stood by the stern rail and watched Keijo in the stern of the dinghy disappear into the darkness. The little 3HP outboard puttered softly, and the beam of Keijo's flashlight threw an erratic beam in the darkness. At last he reached the island, and the outboard motor cut out into silence. The flashlight was extinguished. Cheng turned back to the girl. She sagged against her bonds. She looked very pale in the cockpit lights, and her hair was an untidy copper bush. Cheng took a few moments longer to savour the moment. Physically, the woman was unattractive to him, and she was much older than he liked, but nonetheless he felt his excitement mounting. Soon he would be so absorbed and transported that such small adverse considerations would be of no account. He looked around him carefully, taking his time, considering the circumstances. Lamu Island was 12 miles from the mainland, and the lake crocodiles infested the waters around it. They would immediately devour any offal that was dropped overboard, on top of which he was under the protection of President Tafari. He went back to the girl and adjusted the tourniquet around her upper arm, massaging the veins in the inside of her elbow until they stood out thick and blue in the cockpit lights. He had used the drug on many previous occasions, and he kept the antidote and disposable syringe available at all times. Only seconds after he injected the antidote, Bonnie Mahoon opened her eyes and peered at him groggily.
"Good evening, Miss Mahoon." Cheng's voice was throaty with excitement. "You and I are going to have a little fun together."
There had been an almost immediate rapport between Daniel and Seppu. It was strange, for in every way they were completely different. In size and colour and shape and mentality, there was no similarity whatsoever. It had to be a thing of the spirit, Daniel decided, as he followed Seppu through the forest. They were children of Africa. Its pulse beat in both of them. Its soul was their soul. They understood and loved this land's beauty and savagery, and treasured its bounty. They understood and loved its creatures, and counted themselves merely one amongst its multitude of species. When they camped that night, they sat close to each other beside the fire and talked quietly. Seppu spoke to him of the secrets and the mystery of the forest and the deeply felt beliefs of his people, and Daniel understood. In some measure they were his beliefs, too, and he accepted the reasons for the customs of these people, as Seppu explained them, and admired the wisdom and virtue of their law. Seppu called him Kuokoa, which meant the one I rescued. Daniel accepted the name, even though he knew it was meant as a monument to Seppu's deed and a reminder of his debt to the old man.